Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Companies Editor Ian Smith. How are you doing, Ian?
Not too bad, John. How are you?
I'm all right. And Alex Newman. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm okay.
Good. And Alex, you've written this week's cover feature.
I have.
The World's Best Minds. You wanted to call it Minecraft.
Yes, but for legal reasons, we erred on the side of caution.
We erred on the side of caution, but however, we have a Minecraft-themed cover. So
yes, and so. For listeners who are unaware of Minecraft and who aren't 9 years old, we should point out this is a really popular game with kids. Computer game, that is.
I'm pretty sure it's popular with adults as well.
Where you build things up rather than dig into the ground, is that correct?
You can. No, you have to dig. You have to dig. You have to gather... You have to gather resources and then deploy them to build amazing magical castles and things like that.
A perfect setting for this discussion.
It sounds massively time consuming, which is probably why anyone with a job has done well to avoid it. Okay, well, we'll talk about the cover feature in a minute. It's fascinating. It's a great feature in which we talk about some of the world's best minds, basically the most prospective minds that are out there and who owns them. But let's start with news, Ian, because it has been an interesting week. I mean, it's not, you know, we're not in kind of peak news season, but there's been some good stuff going on.
Yeah, depending on your perspective. Yeah, we haven't had
good stuff. Bad stuff.
Good stuff. Interesting stuff.
Interesting stuff.
There hasn't been a deluge of corporate stories yet. That is coming in the next few weeks with the corporate results season. But there's been some really interesting wider stories, one of which you picked up on in your editorial this week, the nuclear sector, which has really been a focus. Following the write-down, the $6.3 billion write-down put out by Toshiba, the Japanese conglomerate that produces everything from TVs to... Nuclear
reactors.
Yeah, exactly right. And they've had problems with this Westinghouse division, which is mainly US-based. They bought it actually from BNFL.
British Nuclear Fuels.
Exactly, in 2006, which is a UK government-owned body. And really, I suppose the nuclear industry, the narrative it hangs around the disaster in Fukushima in 2011. And after that, people started to become quite concerned or more concerned about what part nuclear would play in the energy future and the viability and the profitability of building nuclear power plants. So people had thought for a while there might be reasons to worry about the value of this division. Then Toshiba had that big accountancy problems where they're overstating their profits over a number of years, and it all started to culminate last year where they did a write down. It's further complicated by the fact that it involves Westinghouse's own purchase of Stone and Webster, which is a nuclear construction company, from CB&I, Chicago Bridge and Iron. So problems to do with that acquisition and the value that placed on the assets and the projects underway then led to a write-down last year. Towards the end of last year, a further promise of a bigger write-down, and then this big number that we kind of saw in the news this week. So it's been building for a while. But, yeah, that doesn't understate the impact that it's had on the share price, as you can see in the chart of the week this week.
So this is a kind of a tangled web. Our readers don't necessarily, our listeners even, don't necessarily need to untangle, because I suspect there are not many of our readers who have shares in Toshiba.
For the wider picture.
But there is a bigger narrative here.
Yeah, which is the viability of building nuclear power plants, where you'll get the funding to build these plants, and the prices that you can get, and that's something you've picked up on.
Yeah, I mean, so we had a new prime minister who took the reins earlier last year, in fact, time flies, and one of the first problems he had to deal with was the Hinkley Point project, the new reactor that has been on the drawing board for a long, long time down in Somerset. So
there was discomfort there.
There was massive discomfort there. You know, there was the ability of EDF, who are the big partner on that project, to actually deliver it, because they themselves have some financial troubles. And as I mentioned, there are certainly, you know, obviously there is political turmoil in France. I don't think that's an overstatement of the situation we have in France at the moment in terms of what is going to happen there with its new government and the elections coming up this year. And also the involvement of the Chinese, who are big funders of the Hinkley Point project, but on the basis that they are allowed to build their own reactor 10 miles from my house.
Yeah, this feeds into wider questions, right, of the economic, energy security of the country. And that's where there was some concern about foreign control of certain important stations.
Indeed, indeed. And there were also concerns when the Hinkley deal was eventually struck at the price that was being offered, the price for the electricity that was going to be produced, the price that was being offered to EDF for that, which seemed very high. And actually, since my editorial was written yesterday, there have been further developments on that front, which you mentioned to me earlier.
Yeah, so the UK government said for future projects that the price promised by the people building the power stations in terms of the price of the electricity coming out of them would have to be 15-20% cheaper than what was agreed around Hinkley Point. I think it was an FT story on Wednesday. And yeah, that's just interesting because obviously we knew to sign that Hinkley deal, it was reported at the time that was a very high price that they were baking into it, right? So it's not surprising that they would be going for a kind of lower price in future projects. But it does feed into this question that you raise, which is what kind of prices are you going to have to promise to get the necessary funding, and which countries, given the turmoil in certain markets, are you going to be able to find to fund these projects? So something I was looking at earlier, there was an expert on the sector saying there was just three potential countries now that are seen as being possible nuclear funders of these kind of plants, and that's South Korea, China and Russia. And even within those, as we were saying, there are question marks over them entering certain markets.
I would find it very surprising that that anyone in governments in the UK or certainly the US would be very comfortable with a Russian company or even a government-backed entity building a nuclear power plant in their country, given that they are massively concerned even about the influence of Russia in elections. And actually, there was even suggested this week that Russia is trying to influence the outcome of the French election, which is mad.
Which is mad, and it's obviously that's the problem when you start dealing about these massive issues that you can kind of start to lose the thread. But yeah, I think the political risk and the concerns there is something that investors or our readers that are kind of getting exposure to some of these industries have to bear in mind. Where is the money going to come from, and what is the political risk around some of that money?
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing I mentioned in my editorial is the local risk. So whilst the nuclear power plants proposed for 10 miles from my house has yet to really garner any significant opposition, although there is opposition, there are groups locally who are very concerned about what is going to be built and the viability of it and the security and safety of it. Actually, that's not the thing that creates most opprobrium where I live. It's the plans for new housing. And, you know, and we saw the white paper last week. You know, there is a demand for much more housing, as well as, you know, energy infrastructure, transport infrastructure. And even that faces massive opposition at a local level.
So you strike a note of caution for investors thinking that there's going to be projects shortly in the pipeline.
Yeah, I mean, this is the point of my editorial, because I do like to, you know, frame it in a in the context of what investors may be looking at. And you may have heard these big narratives about nuclear renaissance, or that, you know, the great future of the housing market, given how much demand there is and such a shortage of supply. And I just think we have to be very careful where there is politics involved at the top, you know, the highest level of government, and also at the local level of government, that can stand in the way of these things. This isn't China. You can't just build things because you want them or even need them.
Except for Trump's wall, which is definitely going to happen.
Apparently so.
But that's okay, because Mexico is going to pay for it, so that's fine.
Apparently so. So actually, Alex, one of the mines that you mentioned in your feature is Salamanca, which is a uranium miner.
Yeah, so the uranium mining in question is Berkeley Energia, but the project is Salamanca in Spain. I think one of the big reasons for investing, one of the big cases for the stock is that it's a reliable supply of uranium for European European buyers who are a bit cautious about sourcing their uranium from Kazakhstan and Central Asia. So, that sort of security in the supply chain, which goes with it in the case of this particular project. But I think it's a bit of a one-off in terms of the mines we've looked at, and this issue has a very, very important strategic political element to it as well. So
indeed, I mean, you know, actually one of the things I did when I wrote this editorial was to look at actually the amount of new nuclear plants that had been built in recent years in both the UK and in France, which is obviously Europe's, you know, leading nuclear power, certainly in terms of the installed base of power. Germany is retrenching from this, we know. Certainly, you know, Fukushima gave it very, very much cold feet in this respect. China, I mean, you look at China, I mean, you know, what's been built recently and what's planned is absolutely enormous. Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating market, but not an easy one to really get to grips with as a UK investor. I mean, actually, you know, one thing that has been mentioned by us previously, but also I notice in some other media this week, is this idea of small modular nuclear reactors. And there is a company in the news this week that is involved in this project, and that's Rolls-Royce.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's something that Mark Robinson, our deputy companies editor, who covers Rolls-Royce, it's really having keen eye to at the moment. When that can, obviously, for a big company like Rolls-Royce, that's a very small part of what they do at the moment.
Well, it's virtually non-existent at the moment.
Exactly. But it's a really potentially interesting avenue of future growth.
I think it's fascinating because, I mean, just if you haven't heard the story around small modular nuclear reactors, they're essentially much, much smaller, as the name would suggest, than the kind of big sort of 18 billion pound plants we're talking about in terms of Hinkley Point or Bradwell or whatever it might be. The idea is that they can be produced in a factory, that they can be rolled out on a city-by-city basis, and they can be exported. And actually, I noticed in the FT today, which I sent across to Robert, there's a company called Sheffield Forge Masters, which is, you know, a kind of remnant of the UK steel industry, which is involved in making the steel components of nuclear reactors, who are involved in this project as well. I think it's very interesting. I suspect it's going to gather momentum. But for Rolls-Royce, that's not the pressing concern this week, is it? Let's jump to the results section, because Rolls-Royce reported one of its largest corporate loss ever this week, and one of the largest ever seen in the UK.
Yeah, exactly right. And another company where some of the problems that it's had have been previously flagged. There wasn't huge surprises on results day, but they are big problems. So it took a £4.4 billion write down on the value of its financial hedges. So that's sizable. It also had that recent settlement relating to bribery and corruption charges. It had the deferred prosecution agreement with the UK, US and Brazilian authorities. So that's not good news either. If you dig a little bit deeper into the results, you can find reasons to be cheerful or negative. One of the reasons to be a bit more negative, and the share price, I think, did end up further down on the day, even after all the news was previously flagged. The civil aerospace segment was a cause of consternation, to use Mark's term, and particularly it's the aftermarket. So Rolls-Royce makes a lot of its profits from the kind of aftermarket as opposed to the original sales of the engines. And in kind of older, large engine fleets, aftermarket sales kind of fell a bit. So that's the kind of thing that Rolls-Royce investors really don't want to read about. It's a company that is struggling in many respects, but there are reasons to be cheerful about its prospects, and particularly given like the sales of the Airbus A350, which were stronger in the second half. So, you know, some of that kind of civil aviation short-term pipeline business looks good, but yeah, there are concerns about the aftermarket. Then there's the concerns about whether they're able to run their business without incurring further huge legal settlements.
No, I mean, it's a fascinating company. I mean, it's been through the wars. I think we've spoken about this regularly on this podcast. It has a new chief exec. One would suggest there is a certain amount of kitchen sinking going on with what's going on at the moment, that Warren East, formerly of Arm, is doing his best to get this company into a position where they can essentially start again. Not in terms of starting again, it was a 100-odd-year-old company, but certainly starting again in terms of investor sentiment.
Yeah, exactly right. And it might be that it has a lot better rest of 2017. The order intake was higher year on year. I mean, the backlog, you have to then take out of that the kind of currency benefit they've had on the dollar sales. But yeah, even after that, constant currencies, things were kind of ticking up there. So actually, yeah, it could be the kind of kitchen sinking things, like the one-offs, like the legal charge that won't be repeated, and actually it's going to be a lot stronger in future with a decent CEO at the head.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny actually, because you would have expected Rolls-Royce to be, you know, given that a lot of its sales are overseas, to be a big dollar earner. And, you know, dollar earners are the kind of companies that, you know, in the wake of the Brexit vote and the weakness of sterling, we've been encouraged to look at. I've actually said in my editorial, you have to be kind of a bit cautious about this approach. Just simply buying dollar earners is, I would suggest, the recipe for disaster, because A, the dollar may not remain weak, but B, you know, managing dollar fluctuations can be difficult. And actually, I think that's what we've seen here.
Yeah, if you take that approach, check if they've got a big currency hedging
big
program.
Currency hedging against the strong dollar, then, yeah. You're going to be in trouble.
Which many people would have said that's the right way to run the business. You know, you have this huge exposure and then you should manage it. But obviously currency hedges, yeah, it's a tricky game to play, as you say, and it can lead to big losses.
One of the first ever features I wrote for the Investors Chronicle was about companies with dollar exposure. And it was when the dollar was closer to $2 a pound than parity, you know, as it is now. And actually, there were a lot of people at the time who were suggesting that where you have translational exposure rather than transaction exposure, don't hedge.
Yeah.
Because currencies, you know, sometimes they're strong, sometimes they're weak relatively. And, you know, it will even itself out in the end, and investors should take a long view.
Not to mention the fees you pay on actually setting up those operations.
Absolutely.
I mean, look at local authority and interest rate swaps, how they got into huge problems in a rising interest rate environment. They thought, oh, this is definitely the way to do it. And then they got killed by having these really large kind of swap operations in play. Yeah, it definitely can be risky.
Well, it essentially financializes, you know, your P&L when you're not a financial company. And yeah. I just think there's too much risk in doing that. You know, if you're a bank, fine, that's your job. If you're an engineer, maybe not.
Exactly.
Okay, we've had some new listings on the market. We've had one new listing on the market this week, which began trading today. We've got a couple more on the way, which you write about this week. Let's start with the one that's actually here.
Yes, Zafinity, a company from my old beat in the pensions world. It basically does things that sound terribly boring, but are important.
It's because they are terribly boring.
Well, you know, depends who you ask then, and if there's any actuaries listening. But it's a pensions administration and consultancy provider, particularly for defined benefit pension schemes, so the older style of pension schemes where there's a fund to administrate, there's pensioners. And there's a huge amount of rules and regulations to be able to manage and how they relate to benefits. I think that's about 80% of their revenue.
So it's a runoff type business then. It's kind of managing down a book, I would guess.
Yeah.
There aren't too many defined benefit schemes still in operation today in terms of taking new money in.
Exactly right. But people are living longer. And as the chief executive makes a point, Paul Cuff, in this news story, that the runoff for these schemes will take 40 to 50 years because they have pension promises made to people even in their 30s and 40s. And that's probably being slightly conservative. Actuaries have been known to understate that in the past. So, basically, there's a big part of that business that's going to be chunky for a while yet. And then also, obviously, they have the business relating to defined contribution pensions and also, yeah, and their master trust product, which is a type of pension scheme that you sell to employers to help them manage this new auto-enrollment regulation that's come in. So, yeah, it's done well today in terms of its listing on the market. It's one of those businesses where they do operate in a fairly crowded market, but they've got a pretty decent track record. These schemes are going to be around for a while and need business, but you wouldn't expect them to be huge growth stock. They did discuss acquisitions a little bit. Maybe that's how they'll try and grow on the public market.
Yeah, I was going to say, I noticed our kind of sub-head says that this is a company that claims to offer income and growth potential. The growth bit, I was kind of questioning. Income, I get.
Yeah, I think maybe it didn't make into final print piece for word reasons, but I think there might be the potential for doing kind of acquisitions in future. But if you actually look at the amount of leverage on the business, and one of the reasons for the IPO, as we see many times, is to reduce the debt. Mm. I wouldn't say there's a huge amount of headroom in this business to be able to go out and buy other businesses.
So it's an income play, then, really?
I would say it's more of an income play. You know, it's harder to make a growth argument unless, yeah, they do start picking up books, old defined benefit books, as the market consolidates.
But it's kind of similar model then to Chisnara, which is kind of bought schemes in runoff.
Yeah, except that they are administrating live schemes, so it's more of a kind of I'd say it's similar, but they are more of a consultancy in that way.
Okay.
It's two businesses, so they can win and lose contracts, whereas Chisnara will buy closed books of business.
Yeah.
I suppose they're closed in a similar way, but that's going to be stickier business.
Chisinau has been a great investment, certainly for income seekers in the recent years. So
exactly.
So
right.
Maybe worth a look for anyone who's done well out of Chisinau. Maybe worth a look.
Yeah, exactly right. It might not garner the same kind of headlines, but then as we've written about in the past, sometimes they can be the good companies to look at.
Okay, and these companies that I'm about to talk about haven't listed yet, but they are also income plays because they are REITs. REITs being real estate investment trusts, who are obliged by virtue of being real estate investment trusts to pay out a certain proportion of their earnings as income. And these look quite interesting. One in particular I like the look of.
Yeah, REITs.
You can guess which one.
I think I can guess which one. REITs, we picked up on this subject a little bit in the FTSE 350. The REITs section continues to expand from new listings, but also property companies that have decided to switch over to REIT status and to get that tax benefit that you talked about, because they exempt from paying corporation tax if they pay out a certain amount of their profits as dividends each year. So it's attractive to some companies for that reason, because there's a lot of investor demand for these stocks at present. You can see why other companies are coming to the market. Yes, there were the concerns around how Brexit would impact on particularly those REITs that are exposed to the London financial sector, generally the jobs market in London. But there are other areas of safety, and one of the ones which I think you're talking about, which is Impact Healthcare REIT.
Absolutely.
Absolutely right. So it's one of the themes actually that we've picked up on in the title. Jonas Crossland, who covers the sector, has covered some of these REITs that are in areas where the demand for the properties is actually underpinned by, you know, the need to provide healthcare, you know.
Yeah, so we've looked at things like companies that provide primary care properties. In fact, one of them is called Primary Health Properties, if I am right in remembering,
yeah,
which provides basically GP surgeries. We like student property. We like some of the big box property companies like Tritax Big Box REIT, which are kind of exposed to the internet shopping angle. But healthcare is a really interesting one for a number of reasons.
Yeah, exactly right. And we know that there's, just from reading any newspaper on any given day, that there's a big problem with in terms of having enough beds in care homes. And yeah, the need to provide those properties and the kind of statutory underpinning for that income. And generally, the nature of the rents means that they're linked to inflation as well. So that provides certain amount of security for the dividends then paid by the REIT. So those are areas where, as if we were talking about that same reader before that's interested in income stock, there is a level of security here that you probably can't get in other places. And then, like you say, there's also like the big box REITs that play into a certain trend within retail that seems to be fairly firmly established at the moment.
Yeah, and the second REIT that we talk about in the piece is LXI REITs, which is more sort of straight commercial.
Yeah, exactly right. Longer term commercial property, but that's, you know, that's the traditional kind of bread and butter, you know, long term, fairly reliable income.
But lots of safeguards built in there to make sure that income stream is protected in the years ahead.
Yeah, rent reviews to be linked to inflation, and they kind of give targeted net shareholder returns, although sometimes you have to take those with a pinch of salt. But it's a focus on secure income.
And we tip a REIT in the tip section as well this week, albeit a pretty more standard flavour of REIT, to put it one way.
And that's all the clues we're going to give you.
That's all the clues that we're going to give you. You'll have to go and pick the magazine up to find that out. But no, I mean, it is an interesting sector that was hit hard by the referendum, and actually that's created some great opportunities, we would argue.
Yeah, and especially the big ones were hit by it, so perhaps some of the smaller ones that are, as we say, exposed to slightly different sectors, and there are good opportunities.
Okay, right, what else have we got in the news section? We talk about our podcast here that we've done, Alex, that you put together on the simple question, is the stock market overvalued? We don't need to go into that now because there is another podcast where we discuss that in detail.
Well, we have the answer. But you have to find the other podcast to find the answer.
Yeah. Is there an answer?
A conclusive, possibly.
It's a $1 million question. I can't believe there is actually an answer to it. But there you go. And also, you've written the lead news story this week on copper, Dr. Copper, which is flying.
It's flying, and for a very simple reason, that the two largest mines in the world, Escondida in Chile and Grasberg in Indonesia, are now offline. So, I mean, doesn't take much of a mathematical leap to work out that if you take off you know, 6-7% off the world's copper market, then very quickly we can slide into a deficit. So the companies which are affected here, you know, for UK investors particularly, are BHP, which operates Escondida in Chile. They're, as we're speaking now, stepping into some sort of government mediated talks with the unions to try and resolve this strike, which has been going on for about a week now. So we're unsure whether or not that's going to, you know, lead to anything. It sounds like both sides has a bit of a standoff, and that there were some break-ins to the mine over the weekend. Currently, I mean, that's a mine which generates 1.2 million tonnes of copper concentrate a year. And the longer this goes on, you can only expect that the price is going to go up, because that's about 5% of global supply. That's absolutely enormous.
Yeah, I mean, we published the copper price, the LME, London Metals Exchange, 3-month copper in our commodities box. Yep. On the 7 days market stats page. And yeah, I mean, it's pretty much trading close to year highs.
Yeah, so it's up to a near 2-year high. Obviously, copper has been quite oversupplied in the last couple of years. There has also been weakening Chinese demand, which, I mean, this is a very, very old familiar story, you know, changed the record, but that has been sort of dominating the you know, copper low prices for a couple of years now. But it looks to be springing back into a deficit this year. So even ahead of this, we were quite bullish about copper, and we've tipped a few copper only plays. I mean, obviously, if you're buying into a copper only stock, I mean, the copper price is the dominant theme to your investment, and we can talk a little bit about this when we talk about the feature.
Absolutely.
But, you know, for the likes of BHP or Rio, who you know, have a 30% stake in the Grasberg mine, a little bit more hedged to you know, the fluctuations in any individual commodity, which is obviously a very, very good thing, because if Escondida was the only mine that BHP owned, you know, who knows where their share price would be at the moment, because that's a huge, huge amount of earnings which has come off the table.
Yeah, so I mean, this sounds to me like it's a supply rather than a demand story, because I can't imagine that Chinese demand has suddenly accelerated.
The Chinese demand story is entirely reliant, it seems, on the housing market in China, which is a consumer of about, you know, some estimates are sort of up to half of all global copper, and, you know, even more when it comes to iron ore. That has rallied further than people were expecting in the last year, but it's, you know, there's some signs that it's getting a bit overheated, and exactly right. It's not a demand story at the moment. We're not expecting demand to surge, but you see just how tight some of these metals markets can be when, you know, you just have two mines going offline for the price to shoot up.
Interesting. So that would suggest to me that individual mines, which barely get looked at in you know, in terms of the way we analyse stock markets, are really, really important.
They are, yeah.
And so the feature is really, really timely, because what you've actually done is, rather than looking at the listed companies themselves, you're actually looking at the mines. Mm. So we've kind of taken it reversed, what we usually do.
Yeah, we have. I mean, for followers of AIM, this might not be that unique an approach, because when you're investing in some of the companies we've picked out here, you're really backing one project. So we mentioned Salamanca earlier, the Berkeley Energy uranium project. Berkeley, if you're investing in Berkeley Energy, it's all about Salamanca. Ditto projects like Tarisa, which is it's been a very, very successful main market listing, which came on last year, which is a South African platinum and chrome miner.
You also mentioned Atalaya Mining in the news story.
Yeah,
which is copper.
Yeah,
and pure play.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's that was a revitalised, very old copper mine, which is on a shoestring, been brought back to life. High costs, but you know, at these prices of copper, it's quite leveraged, and the shares doing quite well. So AIM investors will be familiar with this approach to look at one mine specifically. Obviously, that has real drawbacks. You know, if uranium prices fail to get off the ground, that's really, really bad news for Berkeley Energy long term. We don't think that's going to be the case, because they've already got off-taking agreements in place well ahead of current spot prices. Ditto Sirius Minerals, which I'm to be honest, warming to this story. You know,
always is a contentious one, Alex.
It's always a contentious one, but but now they've got, you know, they've got stage one funding in place. The shares have come right down after the heat which we saw last year. But, you know, they've got offtake agreements in place. And this was a previously a concern of the North Yorkshire potash mine, that they just weren't going to get buyers for the polyhalite. But, you know, the size of some of the offtake agreements they're now getting would sort of underline that there is a market for what they're digging out of the ground.
Explain to me, Alex. Mm. You talk about offtake agreements. You talk about buyers. And you made me change something in the feature.
Yeah.
To distinguish between a buyer and an offtake agreement. So
I think for the purposes of that change, it was a clarification between buyers in the market, as in you or I would go and buy the shares.
Right.
And offtake agreements, where these might be slightly longer dated contractual arrangements between a miner and a buyer.
Are they firm? They're firm purchase agreements, are they?
Yes. Well, I mean, and there's lots of different contracts the way you can spin this. So in the gas markets, you have take or pay agreements where, you know, if you decide not to buy, you're still going to have to cough up some of your commitment. You know, some of the purchase price, and it's different every market. But for example, uranium. You know, if you're an EDF, you really really want a stable and long term supply for your reactors. So you buy 10 years in advance. So that, you know, these are sort of offtake agreements I was referring to.
Right. Okay. Sorry for the tangent there.
Forgiven.
Let's come back to the feature.
Yeah.
Where do we go? Are there big themes that you're pulling out of this? Having looked at these 25 mines that we look at, which cover the whole gamut of commodity complexes out there, what do you conclude as a kind of big, you know, takeout from offtake from doing this from this exercise?
I mean, costs really are everything. I mean, when you're investing in companies in the mining sector, the potential returns you're going to get is obviously a play on how profitable it is to extract a commodity, you know, anything from the ground at any one point in the cycle. So you have with for example, I'll pick out a Rio Tinto's Pilbara iron ore mines. These are just, you know, some of the lowest cost iron ore production in the world. They're going to be making money almost regardless of where the price is. But in a sense, you're not quite as leveraged to price fluctuations as a higher iron ore cost miner. So that's something I think investors have to pay particular attention to, because the margin growth isn't necessarily as big if iron ore shoots up from $70 to $80 and you're producing at $30 as it is if you were producing at $60 and it goes from $70 to $80. Similarly, what I've picked out a number of mines in this list, where they have byproducts or secondary revenue streams. For example, Tharisa was a company I mentioned a little bit earlier. They sell platinum. Platinum market is still a bit depressed at the moment, but they also have a byproduct of chrome, and they make specialty chrome concentrate, which is in a market which is completely constrained at the moment, and there's a huge deficit, the price of which has nearly tripled in the last year. So it almost acts as a sort of hedge for the mine, so they're not totally reliant on wherever the platinum market is going to be. So these are some things, you know, it's important to, I think, to consider when you're looking at any particular project.
Okay, I mean, you mentioned iron ore.
Mm.
There's not many iron ore miners here. And I guess that is because, as you say, it's all about cost, and the only really attractive mines are the ones that don't cost much, because I think you mentioned in the feature, the expectation is that the iron ore price is not sustainable where it is today.
Yeah, I mean, it's rocketed to now, you know, even in the last week, it's jumped again. But, I mean, the projections coming out from, you know, the Australian Mining Ministry and the companies themselves are that it's going to fall. So for that reason, I didn't include too many iron ore miners here. So I tried to keep it relatively topical as well for companies whose prospects, you know, in the near term are also looking, you know, slightly more favourable.
I guess smaller iron ore producers just simply can't compete in cost terms as well, given what you've just said.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a trend, I mean, not that long ago, for, you know, small AIM companies to have found, you know, this has got a very large chunk of iron and people went mad for it, but actually getting it out of the ground at a cost-effective price doesn't seem to be within their means.
Yeah, and if you look at Rio Tinto's Pilbara mines, they coordinate a number of mines from one centre. They have, you know, made huge investments in mechanisation and automation, so they've taken, you know, big chunks of the labour cost out of their models. That's not something that smaller iron ore miners can really compete with. And I mean, that's demonstrated by it's something north of 70% of the iron ore market is controlled by about three companies. So it's not a commodity, you know, where upstart new entrants can really make much of a dent, I don't think.
Yeah, indeed. Precious metals, get a good look in here.
Yeah, I mean, they're very well represented on AIM, and even in the FTSE 100, you know, there's quite a big weighting to gold and silver miners. Again, here, I mean, another thing to look at here are grades, which sometimes get a little bit overlooked, but it can be a useful thing for miners to rely on when prices may be slightly lower, that they can move their mining plan to parts of the ore body where they're able to make a lot more money at lower processing costs.
Yep.
So that's an important thing to consider as well. One company is singled out is Mariana Resources. I mean, it's a very early stage gold miner. They're not even a gold miner yet, but they have this asset in Turkey called the Hot Maden project. They're a junior partner in that. But the grades they've sort of stumbled across there, you know, an average of 11 grams a ton, that's just well above everything else you can find on the market. So it's very interesting to see what's going to happen there. Presumably when they publish their pre-feasibility study, and we're expecting things on that later in the year, they're going to be able to show a very, very low cost for extraction because the grades are consequently so high.
Okay, I mean, and there's lots of mines that you mentioned that are looking perhaps in sort of more off the beaten track end of the commodity spectrum. So, you know, things like titanium and nickel, which don't necessarily they don't grab the headlines, but interesting and potentially profitable for a lot of companies.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean,
molybdenum, manganese. Yeah.
it's always a balance, isn't it? And you know, particularly in less traded commodities, the spot price can be a bit more erratic. So they don't have derivatives contracts, you know, to the same degree that you know, some of the base metals do. But you know, these can be very, very profitable metals if there is a shortage of supply. So, I mean, we spoke about chrome earlier. That's one example. It's a far smaller market, but when the market contracts or supply contracts, it can be very, very profitable.
Okay, let's come full circle with this podcast. We started with energy, nuclear. We've spoken about uranium. What we haven't spoken about is lithium.
Mm.
And lithium is on your list, Bacanora.
Yes, we have talked about Bacanora and lithium a number of times before.
Let's talk about it again. It's really interesting because, you know, when I look at the future of energy, I just can't help but think batteries are going to play a huge role in it. And lithium is really important in the kind of the modern battery.
Yeah, and you know, the sources of lithium or lithium carbonate which are used in batteries are quite confined to parts of certain countries in South America. The good thing about Bacanora Minerals is that it is a sort of pure play on lithium carbonate, which you can't really find with many other. I think with one or two exceptions, you can't find at all on the London Stock Exchange. But I mean, Bacanora, considering the hype which is attached to lithium and the electric car revolution that we're all waiting for. It's sort of surprising to see in some ways that the share price has remained as flat as it has for the last, you know, year or so. So, you know, still a big discount to their net asset value, you know, that their brokers have, the brokers' numbers have put up. And from 2019, it's going to be producing about 17,500 tonnes of battery-grade lithium carbonate. And that's meant to double 2 years after. So there's huge potential for this mine. You know, perhaps there's some doubts about the speed and force at which lithium is going to be taken up, but I think we're pretty confident that one day it is going to be a very, very big thing. It's just timing, really.
Yeah, but I think perhaps investors today are somewhat more circumspect about how they go about investing in the resources sector. Mm. It has been difficult in the last few years.
Largely horrible.
I'd go as far as saying. Yeah, indeed. There are signs that it's on the turn. Mm. But, you know, I think actually if investors are taking a more considered view of the sector, then A, this feature is a great place to start, and B, that's very sensible.
Yeah, I mean, it was the best place to invest your money last year if you were looking at equities markets. I mean, commodities just soared, really, and that was that was from an absolute nadir in January and February, where people thought some of the big miners were going to go to the walls. So it does pay to be invested, but you know, as we've said many times before, we're talking about REITs earlier, which is the opposite end, you know, the truly boring, unvolatile end sometimes of investments that natural resources, you know, they can be very, very, very volatile and, proceed with caution.
But if you ignore them altogether, then as we saw last year, you lost out massively.
Mm. Absolutely. Proceed with caution, but before you proceed anywhere, read this feature. Okay, brilliant. Thank you, Alex. No, it really is a truly enlightening feature. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ian. Plenty more in the magazine, as usual. Results starting to ramp up a little bit. Results this week from Reckitt and Henderson. We've got some stuff in fund management. Obviously, Rolls-Royce, which you've already mentioned. GSK, which we haven't talked about, and Smith & Nephew, which is another provider in the healthcare sector. But yeah, it's going to start getting busy from now on, isn't it, Ian?
Yeah, I think probably about twice as many results next week.
Lovely.
And then even more the week after.
Can't wait. Lots in the personal finance fund section, which they will talk about on their podcast tomorrow. Obviously, the usual tips and comments and such the like it. And even more in the news section we've had time to discuss today. John Rosier, our private investor diarist, is back with his monthly column. And things are getting a little bit better there. Always worth keeping up to date with a real life portfolio and how that's going, and how he goes about managing that and the thought process behind it. And yeah, wow, there we go, another exciting week. We haven't mentioned Cobham, which has had a huge profit warning today in the aerospace sector. We won't,
another one,
let's save that for next week. But I suspect things are about to get interesting.
Mm.
So stay tuned. But in the meantime, pick up this week's magazine, The World's Best Minds: How to Craft a Perfect Mining Share Portfolio, £4.90 in all good news agents, or get online and subscribe. Thank you very much. See you soon.